Hi, everyone. It's just awesome to see your faces. I just think it's a miracle that you're here in this day and age, that anybody, you know, cares about these things anymore. I just am in awe of you. We were just saying it's good that it's not so cold today, because maybe no one would have come. But, you know, I run. I know I talk about it a lot, but I've been running in the canyon, and it is so dang cold out there. And my daughter said, "Why are you doing that? Are you trying to die?" But, you know, yesterday when I went up, it was 0 degrees. And so I brought this Robert Frost poem to you, to read to you, Fire and Ice. And I know you probably have heard it. Everyone thinks Robert Frost is this folksy, comfy, you know, poet, but he's really not. I took a graduate class in him and had to write a essay on his poem, Design, which is a very frightening poem. But anyway, here is Fire and Ice. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. It's very... Okay, we are talking today about John 5 and 6, Matthew 14, and Mark 6. And we'll be mostly in John 5 and 6, although a part in the others also. And the sixth chapter of John is a chapter just full of marvels, full of wonders. It tells of a great miracle, a great storm, and a great sermon. Excuse me. So Jesus is beginning the third year of his ministry. He's left Jerusalem before Passover, and it's probably due to the opposition that he got, and returned to Galilee. And so if you open your books to John 5, and just look over the page at the last verse of chapter 4. This is again the second miracle that Jesus did when he was come out of Judea into Galilee. So he's gone from Jerusalem, which is down here in the country, back up to Galilee. And he will stay in Galilee for 3 to 4 months, and then move back down to Judea, then over the Jordan River to Perea, where Lazarus lives, for 3 months, and then finally back to Jerusalem, where he ends his life. So he's now getting in this period where he is really focused on his primary purpose for coming into the world. But before he leaves Jerusalem, this interesting and pivotal miracle occurs. And it's probably the reason he had to leave Jerusalem. And that is the miracle at Bethesda. And I'm just going to talk about it a bit. And I think we may have talked about it slightly, but I can't remember. And I don't think Diane can either. Anyway, so Bethesda means house of mercy or house of the stream. It's probably southeast of the temple where there was a natural spring. And it was an intermittent spring, and so every once in a while it would bubble up from the ground. And so it was this natural phenomenon that people gave supernatural powers to. And so people would sit or lie by the pool, and they had this idea that every once in a while an angel would come and stir the waters, and whoever got into the water first would be healed. And so that's starting in John 5, and that is what it says in 4, and they would say that an angel came down and stirred the waters. So in John 5 it says, "And a certain man was there, which had been there 38 years, and waiting for Jesus, or a person to help him, put him into the pool, but it was always the first person in, and so he never got in. So in verse 6, when Jesus saw him lie there, and knew he had been there a long time, he saith unto him, Wilt thou be made whole? And then he heals him. So now here's an interesting thing. The usual order of Christ's miracles here is reversed. It's not a reward of faith. It is a product. It's not a product, it's done to produce faith. The man didn't even know who Jesus was. But Jesus knew him. He heals him on the Sabbath. He tells him to take up his bed and walk, verse 8. And the Jews are furious. And why? Why are they so angry? Because he healed him on the Sabbath. So what he violates is making this man carry his pallet home. The Jews therefore said unto him, that was cured, verse 10, it's the Sabbath day, it's not lawful to carry your bed. And he answered him, they asked him who had helped him, and he said, I don't know. So, you know, in those days with all their rules and their laws, they would argue, and we've talked about this, could a man with a wooden leg walk on the Sabbath? Because was his leg a help, or, you know, part of him, or was it a burden? And two men couldn't carry a loaf of bread, but one man could. So they had these laws and regulations. And so the Jewish leaders in verse 12 demand of him, who did this? What man is that which said unto thee, take up thy bed and walk? Not who healed you. Who helped you after 38 years? But who ordered you to pick up your bed and walk? This is a very malignant way to think, isn't it? And afterwards, when Jesus finds him in the temple, he says this interesting thing. Verse 14, he says, Behold, thou art made whole, sin no more, lest a worse thing come unto thee. And then what happens? The man departed and told the Jews who it was that had healed him. So Jesus knew his character. He knew he was not a trustworthy person, and yet he heals him. So here's a question. Does suffering make a man or woman a better person? Does suffering purify always? Isn't that an interesting question? Because usually we think that it does, but did it in this case with this man? No. So it's really all in what is happening in here, isn't it? You can be it can make you better, or it can make you a bitter, vindictive person. Doesn't matter. So verse 16, because of this incident, the Jews persecute Jesus and came to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. So there are so many interesting questions to ask about this incident, and I'm going to ask you a few. Where is the faith here? I mean, we read in Ether 12 and 30, you know this verse, "For the brother of Jared said unto the mountain Zaran, remove, and it was removed. And if he had not had faith, it would not have moved. Wherefore, thou workest after men have faith." Where is this man's faith? Well, I asked my husband and he told me the answer. His faith was that he lay there 38 years hoping. And when John said that to me, I thought, that is so true, because sometimes that is all we can do. We can just stay where we are and keep the faith and keep hoping. I thought it was a wonderful little lesson. Here's another question. Why would Jesus heal this man when he knew he was going to turn on him? He went straight to the Jews. When it says the Jews, it usually means the leaders, the Pharisees, the scribes. Why would he heal him when he knew he was about to turn on him? Isn't that an interesting thought too? Well, the man probably told on him out of fear, right? What they would do to him, but that's the point. At what cost is our loyalty to Christ? Jesus does not abandon this man, and he won't abandon us, and that is the point. At the end of 6, if you just look quickly, he speaks about Judas. Jesus answered them, verse 70, "Have not I chosen you 12, and one of you is a devil?" And he spake of Judas Iscariot. When he says devil, that is translated not Satan, but a person who was bad, you know, kind of. He knew Judas would betray him. Maybe he was hoping he wouldn't. But he stays loyal to us. And if you look in 2 Timothy 2 and 13, you have this really interesting verse. He says, "If we believe not, yet he abideth faithful." If we believe not, yet he abideth faithful. He cannot deny himself, because that is who he is. That is who Jesus is. He stays loyal. Here's another question. Have you ever wondered why Jesus heals so much on the Sabbath day? It keeps popping up. And maybe that's what we have in here, because then incidents happened, you know, they responded, so we don't really know which comes first. But we do have many incidents where he heals on the Sabbath day. Why would he do that? What point is he making? Well, look at John 6 and 17. 5 and verse 17. He says, they want to slay him, and Jesus answered them and says, "My Father worketh hitherto, and I work." So if you read, that's kind of an awkward translation. If you read the Revised Version, translation, he says, "My Father is working still, and I am working." So Jesus is giving a new ideal for this Sabbath day, and what is it? It's that on the Sabbath day, it's not all about inertia and lying around. It's doing activities that are good, and you know, you teach this in primary, but the true Sabbath is not inactivity, but a higher kind of activity. Worship, works of mercy, and it's a different kind of working. And then Jesus says later that he's only doing what he sees his Father do. So he's saying, my Father does this also. I'm just doing what he says. In Mark 2, he says, the Sabbath was made for men, not man for the Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. Remember when Jesus, this is in Mark 2, heals the man with the withered hand. And the same thing happens. And in fact, let's look at that. Go to Mark 2, Mark 3, and 2 through 5. This is this little incident. He said unto the man which had the withered hand, stand forth, because the Jews were watching him to accuse him. It's so sly, isn't it? And he says, is it lawful for men to do good on the Sabbath day or evil, to save life or to kill? And of course they couldn't answer him. And when he had looked around about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, he heals the man. That's a strong word, anger. But there's small, rigid minds could not get, you know, past how they were thinking. You know, Tennyson in Idylls of the King wrote, mockery is the fume of little hearts. Isn't that interesting? Mockery is the fume of little hearts, and we mock all the time, don't we? All the time. We mock each other. So then, back to John 5, Jesus explains, I'm just doing what I see the Father do in verse 19. So here's another question. Why do we come unto Christ? Years ago, we had the three-pronged purposes of the church, which was then replaced with the one purpose, to come unto Christ. Although that other one kind of hung around, but then the main purpose became that our purpose in life and in this church is to bring men unto Christ. Why? Why do we? Well, number one, which is my why, is because he gives life, and we'll talk about that later. But we come into Christ to reach the Father. That is why we come into Christ, to return to the Father. Christ is the fountain, but the Father, our Father, is the source. And let me just add that Christ was never interested in rules, as we've talked about. He flatly refused to lay down rules. Instead, he taught principles. And principles can change according to situations. Think of Laban and Nephi. Think of the Sabbath day. So, by saying that, by teaching principles, he does not spare us the responsibility of decision, right? He gives us commandments and the Holy Ghost to guide us, but they're not rules, they are principles. And we have to step in this river of light that is all around us so we know how to live by his principles. Okay, let's go to the feeding of the 5,000, which is in chapter 6 of John. This is, what a miracle. Jesus has returned now to Galilee, and he wants to get away. There are probably conflicts with Jews, there's the push of the crowds, and there's also the news of the murder of John the Baptist, who was his cousin and his friend growing up, and John is murdered by Herod. Remember that story, he has married Herodias, I don't know how you pronounce it, and who hates John the Baptist because he is preaching against their marriage, because Herodias was married to Herod's brother. And so, it's probably Herodias, anyway. She gets her daughter, Salome, to dance for Herod and to ask him, and he says, you know, he's so besotted with her that he says, you can have anything, and she says, I want John's head on a platter. And so Herod is caught, because he doesn't really want to kill John. He actually probably believes he's really a prophet, but he's now caught, and so he murders John. So all this has happened. Do you think Jesus maybe was grieving? I've always thought he did. He was. He wants to get away. His best friend has been murdered, and he feels probably sad. So he gets into a boat. He's traveling along the coast to go up into a mountain, but the crowds of people just are running along the edge of the sea. Like, he's in the boat, and they're just running along the edge of the sea, and they outrun the boat and are there at his landing place for now. So it says in Mark that Jesus had compassion on them because they were as sheep, not having a shepherd, and he begins to teach them. And then in Matthew, the same incident, Matthew says he begins to heal them. Now here's an interesting thing. Look with me in Numbers 27 and 17. So Numbers is right before Deuteronomy. And every once in a while it's good to go back, because this is all one seamless river here. It's all part of each other. So do you have it, kind of? Most of you? So he's talking about here, Moses is, God has said to Moses, you can't go into the promised land because of what happened with the water and everything, and that's a whole other story. But then Moses says, this is back in earlier, Moses says, but these people need a leader. If I can't, you know, he doesn't argue with him. This is totally off the topic. Moses doesn't argue with God. He just says, he accepts it. He probably knows he had done something. Moses, the meekest man who ever lived, and says, well, they need a leader then. And God says, and the Lord said unto Moses, this is 18, verse 18, then take Joshua. Joshua will lead them in. But before he says that, look at verse 17, which may lead them out and which may bring them in. He's saying they need a leader, that the congregation of the Lord be not as sheep which have no shepherd. Those are the exact words that we read about this incident. The Isn't that beautiful? That this is carried on. It's just one piece. So, back to John 6. At some point, Jesus and his disciples realize that the people are hungry. They've not come with food, and he's been, teaching them all day. And then we have this miracle, this beautiful and stunning miracle, which is one of the only incidents that all four gospel writers give us. They all have it in their gospels. And John, who usually does not talk about what the others have talked about, he picks it up and puts it even in his gospel. But he's using it as an intro into the Bread of Life discourse. He connects them. But we're stopping on that. Anyway, so look at verse 5 of chapter 6 of John. He was up in the mountain, he comes down, and he realizes that the people are hungry, and he turns to Philip, verse 5, and says, Philip, where can we buy bread for these people? And Philip is kind of negative. Verse 7, he says, there's no way we have enough money to buy them bread. And then Andrew jumps in. Andrew, who is likable and unostentatious and very efficient, and says, verse 9, well, there's a lad here who hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. So Philip, unlike the other apostles, had not sought Jesus out. It was Jesus that went to him and called him as an apostle, as his disciple. You have to wonder, why Philip? Why in verse 5, if there are 12 of them there, does Jesus say to Philip, Philip, what shall we do? What is going on? It's just a little thing, but it's so interesting. Did he lack drive? He's not the one that went after Jesus to be his disciple. Did he lack initiative? He's a very steady, sober-minded personality, but maybe not one to take leaps of faith. So why single him out? Well, look at verse 6. And this he said, Jesus, to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. Jesus knew what was about to happen. So you can see parallels of this in the temple if you've been listening. He says to Philip, almost, he already knows the answer, but he says, what shall we do? Well, you can probably see the application in your own life. I mean, it's so hard for us to see the big picture of our lives, isn't it? But God sees it, and like Neil Maxwell used to say, he's always tutoring us. And sometimes it's not pleasant, is it? The things that we have to learn. And so he's helping Philip along here. So Jesus, verse 10, has the people sit down. And there's another interesting thing. You could talk about on each of these. Why does he have them sit down? Is he controlling the crowds? Maybe it's just common sense. And he takes these 5 loaves, verse 11, and 2 fishes and gives thanks. In Matthew it says, the same instant, he looks up into heaven and he blessed and broke. What does that sound like? Right, the sacrament. So this is becoming a symbol or type of the spiritual miracles in which he supplies our spiritual needs, because he's also the bread of life. And we're about to go into this great Bread of Life sermon. You know, even Jesus himself calls what he did a miracle here. In Mark 8:19 and on, he brings it up later. So, verse 11, after he gives thanks, he hands the bread and the fishes over to his disciples and has them take it out. So here's a little question that I find interesting. When did the multiplication of the loaves and fishes happen? Did it happen in his hands when he's blessing them and breaking them apart, or did it happen when his disciples are handing them out? We don't know. But it's interesting to think about. And, you know, I read stuff, and it's about 50-50 what people think. It's kind of interesting. I personally think it happens when his disciples are handing them out, because he is always about teaching, you know, people to be okay when he leaves, to, you know, carry it on, and he would want them to experience that, but that's speculation. One last incident about this beautiful miracle, and this is the part I almost love the most. Look at verse 12. When they were filled, he said unto his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost. Therefore they gathered them up, and they filled 12 baskets. Now, if you take that word basket in another translation, or in, you know, the original translation, it means the satchels that the Jews would carry about when they traveled. So what's happening is his disciples are going out and putting all that's left over into their traveling bags. He is helping them, providing them with a little food for later. I once read this little statement, God does not starve his staff. It always leaves us with enough if we follow his plan. Maybe not riches, but always enough. I really believe he is a God of abundance. He wants you to have enough. Notice that there are only 12 baskets, 12 satchels. So the great giver has not one for himself. You know, when my children were at Morningside, we had a principal who adopted a little girl from Romania who was, I don't know, a year old, 2 years old, anyway, a little bit older. And she told us once, when I was in the PTA, that when she brought her home, in fact, this was still happening, this little girl from the orphanage in Romania would hoard food in her cheeks when she ate and keep it there. So after she would eat, she would have these big cheeks. And it took her a long time to emotionally understand that there would be a next meal. And that has stayed with me all these years later. That principle of hoarding. Hoard it, Jesus said, and you will lose it. Right? Annie Dillard, speaking of writing in this wonderful book, The Writing Life, said this, and I may have read this, but it's been a while too. And it's about writing, but it applies to living. One of the few things I know about writing is this. Spend it all every time. Don't hoard what seems good for a later time. Give it all, give it now. The impulse to save something good for a better place later is the signal to spend it now. Something more will arise for later, something better. These things fill from behind, from beneath, like water. Anything you do not give freely and abundantly becomes lost to you. You open your safe and find ashes. So that, when I read that years ago, it changed my life, actually. And it, you know, changed how I wrote my writing methods for sure, but it changed my life. And when I would write, I would put everything I had into that piece, because I realized that there is a principle of abundance out there in the universe. And that if you try and hoard, it becomes lost to you. But if you don't, if you give, it will always fill up like a well. Okay. Now this really sad thing happens in John 6:14. Then those men, when they had seen the miracle of the bread and the fish that Jesus did, said, "This is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world." And then they try and take him by force to make him a king. Wow. And he, of course, knows what's happening, and he has to leave. They go a little crazy. They say, you know, it occurs to them, this really is the prophet that has been prophesied. And I want to stop a minute and read a couple of these prophecies. So go with me to Numbers 24:17. Numbers is right before Deuteronomy. And we'll just read them quickly. 17. This, the prophet Balaam is talking. He says, "I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh." This is Numbers 24:17. "There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel." This is quoted a lot by the Jews. "There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel." So I have brought my star and my scepter, and it's really not a scepter. I mean, not a scepter. So that kind of looks like a scepter. So the star is a messianic symbol of a brilliant ruler. In Revelations 22:16, it says that the offspring of David, the bright and morning star. And then, of course, in Matthew, his star in the east. And who is Balaam? Balaam is the wise man, the prophet. So isn't that a beautiful little parallel? And you find these all through the Old Testament, foreshadowing what is to come. I think that God is a poet, because he's always doing this, foreshadowing what is to come. In Genesis 49:10, and I'll just read you this, there's another use of a prophetic name for the Messiah. It says that the Shiloh come, until Shiloh come. Isn't that a beautiful word? It's in Jacob's blessing to his son Judah. And then in Deuteronomy, the prophet like unto Moses, to whom they were to hearken. They also use that a lot. That's in these Gospels. You know, Talmage said, even as Israel had been miraculously fed during the time of Moses, now is bread provided in the desert by this new prophet. So they compare the manna in the wilderness to the manna Jesus is giving them in this miracle by this new prophet. And they think, he's come again. It's all happening again. He's our new leader, and Jesus has to leave. And then we get this amazing miracle. So back to John 6, of Jesus walking on the water and Peter. Now, for some reason, John does not put Peter in his account of this miracle. You have to wonder why. I mean, I always wonder why. Was he just a little bit jealous? Or I don't know, but let's go to Matthew. So Matthew 14, as usual, I'm talking too long. But Jesus has gone up on the mountain after this incident where he doesn't want them to take him. And a great storm comes up over the lake, which often happens on that lake as the winds come down through those big canyons. And John calls it a great wind in John 6 and 18. But we're now in Matthew, and Mark says that they were toiling and rowing, so they had been rowing all night and are only about halfway across the lake. And Jesus, you have to picture this, is up on the mountain watching them. And because he's up there all night. And in the fourth watch of the night, it says, Jesus went unto them walking on the sea. Well, the fourth watch would have been in military time, which they used between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. So Matthew's account is really quite vivid and dramatic. And as I said, it includes Peter. And here's a question. Why would Christ do this, walk out to them in the water? What was his purpose? So let me read you a couple things. So Arthur John Gossip, who's a Presbyterian writer, a wonderful writer, says, he's quoting Martin Luther, "There was never in heaven or earth a more loving, familiar, or milder man in words, works, and demeanor, especially towards poor, sorrowful, and..." Bye, Annie. Annie just left, my daughter. She's going back to be with you. But isn't it great that she came? Okay, I'm going to start over with Martin Luther. "There was never in heaven or earth a more loving, familiar, or milder man in words, works, and demeanor, especially towards poor, sorrowful, and tormented consciences." But then Arthur John Gossip goes on to say, "These aspects of the Master fill our minds too exclusively. The scriptures make it plain that those who lived with him were conscious that along with that, there was also in him something awesome, tremendous, superhuman, something that awoke in them what was a kind of dread that is too apt to be forgotten." So that is why I love this incident, because it shows, as well as his compassion, his power. And just picture him through the howling winds. I mean, you've seen the paintings of it, and the huge seas, and in the dark, walking across the water. We learn things in our lives, hopefully. Sometimes we need comfort. You know, I wrote a poem about how the earth, I looked up and there was this sliver of a moon between these mountain peaks. And I thought, you know, the earth is comforting that moon. The earth can be so comforting. It holds the seed all winter. Holds it safe and comforts it, you know, comforts it. So I'm all about comfort as well. But I published it in a book and this poem, and got, you know, when you publish, you have to go out, you get little readings, so I had a review. You know, I had some good reviews. But you wouldn't believe this review I got from this man in Ogden, in the Ogden paper, where it said, oh, I can't even tell you. In fact, I tried to look it up so I could read it to you and be humiliated, but oh my gosh, he blasted me for needing comfort. I thought, what is up with this guy, you know? And I look him up. He was a Vietnam vet. He had been in Vietnam and damaged and or hurt. And he probably had this bitterness in him and was just taking it out on this poor woman. Anyway, so I know that comfort is important, but we need his enabling power to get through our lives, not just his comfort. And Jesus is once again showing them that he is the Messiah and that faith is power. And I'll just read you some of these parallels. Proverbs 3 and 4. Who hath gathered the wind in his fists? Who hath bound the waters in a garment? And look at these in Job. Which alone treadeth upon the waves of the sea? Hast thou entered into the springs of the sea? Hast thou walked in the search of the depth? Is that not exactly this incident? So in back to Matthew 26, of chapter 14, verse 26. And when his disciples see him walking on the sea, they are troubled. They think it's a ghost, as you might. And in Mark, it says he would have passed them by. But straightway Jesus spake unto them, saying, be of good cheer, it is I. Be not afraid. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it be thou, bid me come unto thee on the water. And he said, come. And when Peter was come down out of the ship, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him and said unto him, O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt? And when they were come into the ship, the wind ceased. So, how did Peter do it? And why did he fail? That I understand. But what is so stunning is how he did it, isn't it? So stunning. If you look at what he says in verse 31, O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt? Peter must have done it by faith and not doubting, right? So what powerful faith Peter had. It just blows me away. And when you read some things, people are kind of critical of him. I'm like, what? These guys out there walking on the water. Only Jesus could have expected more. Only Jesus. Oh, ye of little faith. So what is faith? What is faith? I have to give my husband credit, because all his adult life, since I've been married to him, he has been trying to figure it out. Gospel doctrine lessons, he'll say, what is faith? Knowing full well he's going to get the normal answers, like, don't you know? You know, blah, blah, blah. He really wants to know and understand it. So, and I'm telling you that because I think he's discovered what faith is. And if we had time, I would see what you thought, but I'm just going to tell you. And I agree, faith is movement. Movement toward the light. So if you think about it, you know, people can be in the absolute worst circumstances and move to the light and rise above them. You read about it all the time. How did they do that? In the New English translation of this verse, Matthew 31, or 14, where he says, O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt? Instead of doubt, it says, Jesus at once reached out to him and caught hold of him and said, Why did you hesitate? How little faith you have. Well, hesitate, instead of doubt, hesitate is a word used in describing a pause in action, isn't it? Why did you hesitate? Why do we hesitate to believe? Why do we hesitate to say we're all in? It's hard, but we do it. We are always taking our minds off Jesus. And then we begin to sink. When he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid. Then our movement becomes towards something else. So what does Peter look at? If you're imagining your mind's eye, he's looking at Jesus, right? He's walking in the water. And then the wind starts to hit him and he's frightened, isn't he? And he lets his fear take over, which is paralyzing. It is paralyzing to be afraid like that. And destruction and darkness and death are all around us. Misery and hatred, dishonesty, slyness. It's all around us. In Deuteronomy 32 and 10, look there with me, because you should have this in your head. Just this little verse is amazing. God is speaking of Israel. You got it? He found him in a desert land and in a waste, howling wilderness. And that is what is around us, the waste, howling wilderness. Believe it, it is. And I'm not being negative. I'm just saying it is everywhere around us. Nothing has changed. That is where he found Israel. And we cannot take our eyes off of him. Not just as a practical matter, because you begin to sink into despair. And you think, you know, my life's over, I don't have anything left to live for. If you're old, if you don't have any money, if your health is bad. That is all a waste, howling wilderness. And we need this to get us through, to keep our mind's eye, to keep moving toward the light. Let me read you something quite beautiful from Farrar, who I use quite a bit, who wrote the Life of Christ, and I know I talked about it at the beginning, the books I would use, but you know, Talmage uses him extensively, so I thought I might as well just read Farrar, you know. Anyway, he said, and I paraphrase a little, if we fix our eyes on Jesus, we may walk over swelling waves of disbelief, unterrified in rising winds of doubt. If we turn our eyes away and instead look at the power and fury of the destructive elements around us, we too shall sink. If we listen while we are in the deep, in the storms and darkness, we can hear those beautiful words. Wherefore didst thou doubt? It is I, be not afraid. So let me just quickly add this and then we'll end. Do you wonder, I wonder, if he brought the storm on himself, if he made it happen? Because the minute he steps into the boat, it stops. And if he did, this is just me, if he did, why? What was he trying to accomplish with his disciples out there? Well, if you read Mormon 9, where Moroni is finishing his father's work, his father has been killed, look up Mormon 9 and 1 sometime. He says, I speak concerning those who do not believe in Christ. So he's addressing this. Doubt not, but be believing, and begin as in times of old, and come unto the Lord. Maybe Jesus wanted them to face their doubts and decide about him once and for all. I don't know that, but let me just end with the church knives. And I'm going to carry this on a little bit, the bread of life, in 2 weeks. I knew I wouldn't have time. But that, when he starts into, in John 6, into that beautiful discourse of the bread of life, it's one of the saddest days in the Savior's life. He says he had crossed the lake, right? And gone down the mountain, crossed the lake, up on the shore, and they say to him, "How'd you get here?" Because they're with him all the time, swarming him. And he says, he never answers questions directly. Do you ever notice that? If you ever want to know how to get rid of a really agonizing person, don't answer their questions directly. Just kidding. I mean, that's Jesus. You can't do that. But he instead answers them with what they need to hear, not with what they want to hear. He never addresses how he got across the lake. He just says, "You are only following me because you want free food." It's so sad. And then he launches into this beautiful discourse. And I don't have time. Do you want to stay in here about the knives or not?
Sure.
Just really quick, okay. I think I told you this before. I read this in a medical book about chert knives. C-H-E-R-T, chert, and then I looked it up on Google, and you can buy them online if you want. These are knives that were made by the Solutrean people, who were prehistoric people in France 18,000 years ago. And these knives are being found all the time, and they make them by overshot flaking. And these people invented the bow and arrow, the spear thrower, and the needle. And they're long oval knives. They're too fragile really to use, but this medical book that my daughter gave me, this man used one a surgeon to open a patient's abdomen because they are 100 times sharper than a steel scalpel. Isn't that amazing? And they can split fewer cells and leave scant scars. If you hold it up, it will pass light through it, especially as it gets to the edges. It's so thin on the edge, it's like air. So this is my analogy, and what I'll end with, that faith is sometimes like that edge between faith. That edge is like the edge between faith and doubt, faith between belief and unbelief. It's so thin, and if you spread it out, you can step into faith. You can decide. It's a decision, I think. We wait for it to be inspired. You have to decide. You have to move toward the light. And we all have to do it. Joseph Smith said that all spirit is material. And so you step across that line into faith, into another world that's more real than this one. Just like the edge of that knife. You can go either way, we can. And I offer that in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Thank you.